many a night while you lay sleeping, dreaming of your amber skies, was a poor boy broken-hearted, listening to the winds that sigh. My little darling, oh how I love you, I love you, none can tell. In your heart you love another, little darling pal of mine. Many a day you I've rambled, happiest hours with you I've spent, thought I had your heart forever, now I find it's only lent. My little darling, oh how I love you, none can tell. In your heart you love another, little darling. There are just three things I wish for. That's my casket, shroud, and grave. When I'm gone, don't weep for me, just kiss those lips that you betrayed. My little darling, oh how I love you, I love you, none can tell. In your heart you love another, little darling pal of mine.
The Berlin Wall comes down, and the U.S. cracks down on illegal aliens. Ban the freedom of choice for those wanting abortion and enforce capital punishment. 24-hour radio ban for indecency, summoned by the FTC. Why are we so anesthetized to the lies? Because we do it in our own lives. We believe all the things that we want to hear, but then we also love to criticize. Bail out the banks, don't march to the churches. Satanic reverses. Bail out the banks, don't march to the churches. Satanic reverses. Bail out the banks, no march to the churches. Satanic reverse. Bail out the banks, no march to the churches. Satanic reverse.
How do you judge this conference and the media activism, the people who like to make independent TV?
It's fantastic, particularly the show. Well, the two things that I attended were last night was the East Europe show, which to me was really phenomenal to simply listen to what the people from Romania and Siberia and Slovenia had to say, and to talk about a kind of dialectic of political action, which is really pretty radically different than I think what goes on in Western Europe, and certainly radically different than what goes on in Canada. So coming from a Canadian context in which, you know, it's been a, there's a reason for us being here is because from the Canadian context, from the North American context, it's impossible ever to get any kind of first-hand information as to the situation in East Europe, as particularly with respect to the media. So the show, the East Europe show for us, was just like sort of like, you know, like what Foucault would say, it's like sort of like, you know, tearing a veil apart and letting the voices of the excluded and the repressed finally speak. And I found pretty fantastic the ways in which they speak. For example, the guy from Siberia who's talking about the woman that they discovered along the river, who I took to be a metaphor of the mind, sort of, they went to sleep for 70 years under the repression of communism and sort of woke up to a handwritten Bible and sort of a disintegration of the Russian language itself. So, and secondly, the show this morning, the show on hardware was for me pretty phenomenal. I don't think it dealt with issues of tactical television, but really dealt with kind of hardware issues, which I think, in fact, are all about the controlling logic of what, you know, the media technological theorist Paul Verlier would say, the controlling logic of the logistics of perception today. So for me, that was just, you know, really provide a lot of, really a lot of.
People were opposing this technology, or putting questions, or only looking at how to use them, or how to use them in for our purposes.
Well, sort of opposing, and there are people in the room right now who were there, so they can speak for themselves. It was sort of opposing, but what I noticed was a nice kind of thing that happened is that everyone began formally with like a critical kind of venue, but by the end of the discussion, the seduction of the technology had crept in, and it was sort of like a techno-geek discussion on high-definition television, band lengths, and whatnot. And so sort of the issues of tactical television had sort of been swept by the board as people got into the real issues of, to, you know, the controlling technological logic behind the media scape itself, behind the war machine, I suppose.
There are no Japanese, I must say, on this conference, because they think all the images not made on high definition are boring and uninteresting, both from an information point of view as from an aesthetical point of view. They think that if people work with, let's say, SVHS, and even with U-matic or Betacam systems, are completely outdated. So this is the Japanese position.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that. But then I also think the Japanese are superior beings these days. Technologically speaking, anyway. So I'm an inferior North American.
So we'll have to deal with Europeans and Americans. We'll have to deal with the situation.
Yeah, we've been left behind, and we're like we need compensatory technologies and compensatory thought to sort of catch up in some ways.
And we'll have to take care of the East Europeans.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose.
Yeah. But I think we should judge this tactical TV from a Japanese point of view also, although they're not here.
I guess so, but if I could just intervene and say that I disagree with the thesis of strategic TV and tactical TV. I think that's been stated, for myself, I think it's stated incorrectly. I think that, because it refers almost to like a stage of power and a stage of media logic that's still accumulative in character, that media cares about power, whereas I think there's a guy, I think he's from East Germany today, and was speaking about pure capitalism, and was saying that the politicians in Germany are in a panic state because the entertainment value of television is such that it's reached a pure sacrificial phase. It's like, you know, what goes on in the United States, the only thing that counts is sort of energize the system by finding the most pathological tendencies in the culture, like standing on freeway overpasses and throwing cars on the rocks in the cars of politicians. Or in the United States, like Amy Fisher, if you just come out of America, Amy Fisher's just had three shows in sequence on her, and she's like, you know, like a budding Madonna as she sits in prison. And each show, each movie on this Amy Fisher, do you know the story of Amy Fisher?
No.
Oh, this is the American media zone this week. It's really been on my mind to see Amy Fisher was a... She was like 14 or 15, she began working for an escort service in the Long Island area. And she's reputed to have an affair with a guy who owned a garage, fixed her car. But the event that brought her to public attention was that she grabbed a gun one day and went and shot his wife. And his wife didn't know anything about this affair. She didn't know anything about this woman. She just opened her front door and shot by Amy Fisher. And her trial was just held maybe 6 months ago, and she was convicted and given 15 years in prison or something. But she'll soon be out because she's a celebrity and you can't hold her in prison. While she's in prison, she got a press agent. The press agent sold rights to NBC, ABC, and CBS. And they each made a movie on Amy Fisher, which showed within a three-day cycle in the United States. Now, the immediate executives were thinking, well, this is insane, we're going to split the audience three times over. But what actually happened was every time the new movie came on, the ratings increased and increased and increased. So it's within the top 10 movies for two of the networks for the whole year itself. And then Amy Fisher just went on hard copy with a porn video that she shot with her boyfriend.
In jail?
No, just before she went in jail. She stacked up a whole series of, I don't know, of media interventions, just like Madonna. She's really going to give Madonna a run for money. All she needs, in fact, is to say that she wants to make love to Madonna, and she'll be up to Hollywood for sure. Because she knows, like Madonna, that you succeed in the media scape today by what Baudrillard would say is a logic of seduction, and that is that you look for the transgression that reverses the ruling logic, that energizes the system by a kind of pathology. So like Madonna's new sex book that's out, you know, as Madonna sort of scrapes every remnant of her Catholic past for its possibilities of transgressive logic.
Did you look in the book?
Yeah, sure.
How is it?
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Things from point of view of quality.
Quality is great. Yeah. The music's great.
Oh, also, and I haven't seen it, so I'm sorry.
Yeah. So my point would be that...
There's nothing new in the book, though. I mean, there's nothing in the book that hasn't been photographed before, but just because she's doing it, she's getting the kind of promotion and other photographers that have done this work have never gotten before, which is typical.
And she has her own company now.
Yeah. Well, like Michael Jackson. Mm. So that's the intervention. But my point for like Madonna and Michael Jackson somewhat would be is that it's not strategical TV anymore at all. It's excremental TV. Because TV now operates under a sign not of accumulation and coherency, but just what the guy from East Germany or from Germany was saying today, it operates under the sign of radical decomposition, cancellation of all the signs, heaping up refuse, scouring out the population for the most pathological tendencies by which it can energize the system itself. So I would say that rather than strategical TV and tactical TV, I'd prefer to use for myself the categories of excremental TV, which for me represents the dynamic logic of television, you know, official corporate television culture today in the age of liberal fascism, and something like what I would call vague TV. Mm-hmm. And vague TV is, you know, is for me as much more is the kind of critical stance that one takes in the age of excremental television. Mm-hmm. And if I could...
Vague TV mixes sources or has no clear sources?
Yeah, or it operates completely in the logic, breaks with the normal logic. Because in the age of like tactical TV, you'd turn to documentalism. Give us, and being from Canada, you know, like to see documentalism here, you know, documentary filmmaking is just like going back to snow or something like this, because that's all the Canadian mind is capable of these days, is to give us the facts and just the facts. But that, I think, is a kind of television stance that's outmoded in the age of excremental culture. Vague TV operates completely within the logic of a television culture which is recombinant in character. Like the descriptions today of like high definition television or just, you know, television editing, where the editing operates on the like a biological logic of cloning, sequencing, retranscription. You know, so there's like this, the ruling logic for television for me is not logic of sociology, which would be strategic TV and tactical TV, but a logic of biology. I think, in fact, the whole television system has actually come alive, and it's a kind of, it's acquired organicity. It's really a technology which has become a life form itself. So excremental television on the one hand, you know, with certain different parts to it, and vague TV. And people I work with, you know, are like Critical Art Ensembles, a television, like a co-op, works in Tallahassee, Florida. And they're pretty interesting because they're real vaguers, because they, you know, they operate within this kind of logic of, they take what you would call the media, universal media archive as their content, and then clone it and retranscribe it and resignify it at will, but all the time trying to introduce elements of real ambiguity and reversal and transgression into their text itself.
So. And they are aware of the fact that they have no viewers?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's true. Yeah. Well, it's true. Yeah, they are definitely aware of that.
They're happy TV makers?
Well, I wouldn't say that. Maybe like everyone else, and that was expressed in the discussion of hardware today, everyone's really frustrated, at least in North America, it seems, by the lack of distribution. like the guy from Deep Dish, you know, he's talking about like a really a creative attempt at good distribution, but that his description just evinces the kind of frustration that people feel when in fact television operates as a war machine and itself controls a logistics of perception by controlling the form of distribution.
Well, on a brighter note,
commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is the reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in this world is so hard to find us, it shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian formed bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where soundbite politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Willie Horton or will he not get elected? On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or gift of love.
Okay, got the idea? All right, now let's pass it, sir.
We're living through television.
TV, is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the whore. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar-sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a union COLA cost of living allowance. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Back again, new and improved, we return to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language, like virtually spotless, fresh, frozen, light, yet filling,
and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined, like recession to necessary downturn, crude oil on a beach to moose, civilian death to collateral damages, and being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia, where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects, where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
I'd like to know a little more about this so-called reality TV, America's most funniest home videos, cops and so forth, because I see that this is somewhere, let's say, besides the MTV, so the music video clip culture, sort of become very rapidly as a world standard. So images have to be like that, have to be reality TV.
Yeah.
But we saw it also in Poland, and the guy from Russia, from yeah. Romania. They make reality TV without knowing, without having ever heard of all these American serials, and they follow the cops and make exactly the same kind of images. Very strange.
In the game shows as well.
Yeah.
That the guy wouldn't talk about.
Yeah.
Which I wish he had talked about.
Yeah.
But no. Yeah. Definitely. And the. From what I could see of the Polish reality TV, you know, like, if you like, Polish top cops seem to be an advance in goriness of what's allowed on American standard television itself, I think. So I think in experimental culture you get four kinds of television emerge, and there's different kinds of shows that go with each. I think there's in experimental culture, television is certainly coeval with the intensification of the disciplinary society, of the disciplinary state. And a lot of shows on American television are all about the very standard model of the disciplinary society, like cops. You know, cops strike fear into everyone and give security to all the white suburbanites who want to know that there are cops around the force itself. Or even take, like, the video, you know, shown repeatedly in the United States of the beating of Rodney King by the L.A. police forces. That serves a kind of double purpose. On the one hand, it shows the kind of brutality of the L.A. police force. On the other hand, it shows African Americans that they better not speed, get out of the car, and have any kind of record if they want to survive. So that's a kind of double message that it's providing all the time. So one, I think that in experimental culture, television is coeval with the intensification of disciplinary effects, like cops or scenes of brutality. Secondly, like in a show like America's Funniest Videos, I think television is means the self delivers itself up when it becomes, you know, in its televisual presence, when, you know, the dominant form of subjectivity is televisual subjectivity, that the self delivers itself up, as Nietzsche would say, as an object of self-abasement, self-humiliation, and self-denigration, so deep and so true. You, in fact, deliver yourself up as a joke when you send your videos into America's Funniest Videos, and maybe you'll get paid for it. Now that, for me, is not particularly a form of liberation. It represents a form of kind of domination and a kind of almost concentration camp denigration of the televisual self that's reached levels of deep pathology. So first, been the intensification of discipline, and secondly, the what I would call like really sacrificial television, I guess. Like one would be disciplinary television. Secondly, like America's Funniest Videos for me would be like a Nietzschean, like a kind of television produced under the sign of Nietzsche. It's sacrificial TV. And in sacrificial TV, you deliver your, you don't simply deliver other people up as scapegoats, although that certainly is the case. You know, everyone's turned into a joke. But you also deliver yourself up as an object for public humiliation, public humor, and getting a joke off on your own tremendous lack of power in the society itself. And thirdly, I would say that in excremental culture, there's television serves the function of surveillance. And it's not even surveillance of the population as a whole. Like Paul Virilio would say, like, you know, in his book, In Speed and Politics, that when you have, like, the dromoscope, you know, when life operates as a war machine and becomes a process of strategy and tactics and control of logistics of perception, and when the body gets boarded as, like, a pirated vehicle, then you have that kind of surveillance for sure, and television definitely works as a war, as part and parcel of a war machine. But it operates and as a form of surveillance in another way, and that's what, in what Marx would say, is that the priest comes true, and the priest, the inner priest, the priest enters into the body in the form of a television monitoring of self-surveillance. And self-surveillance is like America's most wanted. Like there's a new show, just, I don't know if it's on the air in the States, I just read in a paper that the, when they used to tack up the most wanted posters, you know, dead or alive in post offices in Canada and in the United States and in Canada, well now they're going to do a regular show in which these things are simply going to go televisual itself. So surveillance of the population as a whole, but also kind of self-surveillance of yourself. And TV sets the standards for what the self-surveillance will be in the age of liberal fascism. And that is, you can't afford anymore not to be optimistic about technology, and you have to think of technology as freedom rather than technology as a fantastic form of degeneration or of denigration. And the final function, I would say, of television in the age of excremental culture is that it's coeval with the growth of splatter culture. And that, I think, is like one of the really energizing forms of television. It's like all the shows that are coming on the air now about keep your camcorders on all the time to get the biggest crash that you can get. So you can, you know, coming over, I was sort of wishing the plane was crashing just so I can get the video. At least it could be delivered as the last will and testament. But it's about crash TV, and it's about splatter culture. And splatter culture is like a real energizing and kind of pathological motivating tendency of the culture as a whole. That's what I would really mean by excremental culture. That the tendencies that are, you know, really fascinating because they're pathological, that are about refuse and self-cancellation and decomposition. You know, all the tendencies in pure capitalism are in fact come to the fore, and we move television beyond the age of strategic TV to the age of excremental television, in which we're all complicit because we're all, what's our main form of subjectivity but televisual subjectivity.
But I guess you should react on, let's say, the terms we are speaking here at the moment. Yeah. So on this conference, we, for example, we speak about the camcorder revolution, and we speak about witness TV, you know, the Buffalo video festival is called like that, witness TV. And these kind of approaches look at the Rodney King case from a different side.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can say something.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because I think in lots of ways people think of the Rodney King situation as a democrat, you know, a democratic way of people, everyone being able to have new eyes through the camcorder and be able to record things. But in fact, I think people internalize it and becomes a sacrificial type of object. Rodney King, if you're a black person in the States, won't you internalize this beating over and over again? So perhaps there's something right away like a Los Angeles riot. But afterwards, middle-class blacks in particular, even in ghettos, will think in terms of themselves. The next time they're in the car, if there's not a camcorder around and they get beaten up. And so I think in a lot of ways it's a disciplinary approach. It can be used that way as well as something that can be very democratic. So what I would like to know from people that use camcorders is what is the next step? If you use it as a documentation, I think that's wonderful. But what do you do after that? I'm thinking back, going from when painting was realism, when photography was realism, how those things change, how the Dadaist situation has changed things. What would Nietzsche do if he had a camcorder? You know, what can be done? What's the next stage that we could use that would develop in a real democratic way?
What would Nietzsche do with a camcorder?
Yeah, let's try to answer this question. Let's try to figure out.
He would maybe make a reportage on his own life, or without having any others involved.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. Well, I might do. I mean, what would I mean? I think camcorders could be ways of, like, well, Wilhelm said he met this guy in Japan who drives cars as ways of doing philosophy, and I think that you can use a camcorder as a way of doing philosophy as well. And there, people always do it. There's sort of four ways that you can do philosophy with a camcorder. One, you can be be in the representational mode in a realist, and you can do documentalism, and that's, you know, sort of a dominant thing that sort of feeds into media systems. Secondly, you can turn yourself into a scanner function. You can become like a suburbanized height of positivity, you know, where televisual subjectivity leaps right on beyond the screen and comes into your body itself, and you can use it as most people use camcorders, and that is to simply scan life passing. So I know a lot of people who are making like 1,000-hour documentaries of their child's life. Or once I was on a beach last winter in Florida, and this guy got out of this car. He had four children. There's no wife. There's four children in his car. They got out of the car. They had their bathing suits on. They all walked down to the beach, and he had his dressed in black completely. He walked out, and he literally never looked at the ocean. He had, the instant he got out of that car, his eye was wired to the camera, and he was taking, you know, the horizon lines of the ocean and stuff like this. And directing, while he was watching, he was directing his children to do the swim routine. They did the swim routine, and he signals for them to get out of the water, back to the car. They run, and then he does the kind of closing sequences, and then walks back to the car with his eyes still fused with the camcorder, and drove off. So I immediately sat down and wrote a little meditation on what was happening to this kind of personality type. I was pretty amazed by this. It was a real brilliant performance piece, and I don't know if he did it just for us. So, something. Yeah.
It's a pity that you didn't have a camcorder.
Tell me about it. I was a poor man for it. So like scanner, so a lot of like camcorders are documentalism or permanent scanner functions, and who doesn't want to be a scanner function today? I mean, that in the age of, you know, of representationalism as a mise en scène, you know, as a sign of an age already passed, most people will opt for that, and so you turn into a scanner function. Or camcorders for sacrificial uses. And that's, I think, in the United States, you know, with the America's Most Funniest and all these shows that are coming on in crash scenes, this is one of the dominant uses of camcorders. And that is that they perform a kind of psychological function of scapegoating. And the whole audience derives a kind of really vicarious satisfaction from being complicit as a kind of mob psychology in who's going to be the scapegoated victim of the day.
Andrei Ujica, the maker of the film Videogramma einer Revolution, you can see it tonight, told me that during the revolution in Romania, even the people who had a VHS camera during these wild events were, after a very short period, bored by the masses and all the things, and they were looking for accidents in a way. So this is how, let's say, the eye who is fused to the camera is functioning.
Yeah.
Always the hardest, the first day of school, the hallways, the darkness like a gauntlet. The voice is haunted, walking in man with the thin skin, lower chin. He knew the names that they were taunting with: faggot, sissy, punk, queen, queer. Although he never had sex in his 15 years, but when they harassed him, it was for a reason. But when they provoked him, it became open season. For the fox and the hunter, the sparks and the thunder, to push the boy under, then pillage and plunder. Kinda makes you wonder how one can hurt another. But dehumanizing the victim makes things simpler. It's like breathing with a respirator. It eases the conscience of even the most conscious and calculating violator. Words can reduce a person to an object, something more easy to hate, an inanimate entity, completely disposable, no problem to obliterate. But death is the silence in this language of violence. And death is the silence. But death is the silence in the cycle of violence. And death is the silence. It sucks to be on your lawn, to be tougher when we pick on someone else, it might make us feel rougher. Abused by the fathers, but that was at home. So to prove to each other that they were not homos. The exclamation of the phobic fury, executioner, judge and jury. The mob mentality, individuality was nowhere. Dignity forgotten at the bottom of a dumbo dare. And an uncoast stare. On the way home, was back to name calling. 10 against 1, they had us back against the wall. They reveled in the laughter as they surrounded. But it wasn't a game when they all jumped and grabbed. And they picked up the bats with a muscle strain. And they decided they were gonna beat this fellow's brain. With an awful, powerful shout for an hour full of violence. The pictures took the booth out being dominance. They didn't hear him screaming, they didn't hear him bleeding. They ran like cowards and left the boy bleeding in a pool of red. To all tears were shed in his eyes, violence slid into the back of his head. Dead. The death of the silence. In this language of violence, death is the silence. But death is the silence. In the cycle of violence, death is the silence. You won't see the face till the eyelids drop. You won't hear the screaming until it stops. You won't see the face till the eyelids drop. You won't hear the screaming until it stops. Boy's parents were gone and his grandmother had raised him. She was mad, she had no form of retaliation. The fact that not to worry about being on a hit list. But the thing he never thought about was that there was a witness to this senseless crime. Right place, wrong time. Tried as a matter, one of them was gonna do a hard time. Is always the hardest. The first day of prison, the hallways, the darkest, like a gauntlet. The voice is haunted. Faggot, sissy, punk, queen, queer. Words he used before had a new meaning in here. As a group of men in front of him laughed and came near. For the first time in his life, the young bull felt fear. He'd never been on this side of the name calling. 5 against 1, they had his back up against the wall. He had never questioned his own sexuality. But this group of men didn't hesitate their reality. With an awful, powerful shout, an hour full of violence. The victims took his boots off the indominus. They didn't hear him screaming, they didn't hear him pleading. They took what they wanted and then just left him bleeding in the corner. The giant would do it to Jack Horner. Dehumanizing the victim makes things simpler. It's like breathing with a respirator. It eases the conscience of even the most conscious and calculating violator. The power of words, don't take it for granted. When you hear a man ranting, don't just read the lips. Be more sublime than this, put everything in context. Is this a tale of rough justice in a land where there's no justice at all? Who is really the victim? Or are we all the cause, a victim of it all? When death is the silence, in this language of violence, death is the silence. But death is the silence, in the cycle of violence, death is the silence. You won't see the face till the eyelids drop. You won't hear the screaming until it stops. You won't see the face till the eyelids drop. You won't hear the screaming until it stops.
let's talk a little, maybe a little more about the fear of for situations without a camcorder, because I think, I mean, you can, of course you can have your camcorder always with you, but you already, what it was, you told that people fear, let's say, the Rodney King cases without camcorders. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, let's say, that's the constant panic state.
Yeah.
Could I say something?
Yeah, sure.
In the case of the Rodney King thing, it seems to be a case of, like, Americans have a tradition for having a gun with them to protect the property and to protect their person. It's almost like you have to go out with a gun and a camcorder. The camcorder is there to protect your rights. Mm-hmm. So, like, I've got these things on video footage, and the gun's there to protect them in case they get attacked. So it's almost like you've got a double holster, one holster the gun and the camcorder, and then we'll act in a sort of cowboy thing. So I think it repeats the outshot, the video camera becomes out of the weapon, and the line of sight for the gun and the line of sight for the camera become one and the same. Mm.
Yeah, shoot.
Shoot, yeah. Action.
Either with the video or with a gun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as Paul Gowan found out the other day, even then, it was still not safe. I mean, once the images are out in the public domain, I mean, you can be under assault by the other forms of media. And you know, there is, although you feel you're safe with your camcorder, you actually have recorded reality. That other bigger media reality comes upon you, and then that obviously gets attacked again. So it's like a never escalating circle, and everything analyzes something else. You know, start at the bottom, wrong, and like the dominant media comes in, and then everyone analyzes the dominant media, and then the sub dominant media analyzes the dominant media version of the sub media, and it just repeats and repeats and repeats. And I agree with what Arthur was saying, that the tactical TV situation is almost the case where everyone's devising new tactics, but you know, who's going to actually be watching it? Everyone's like making their own tactical TV. Who's left to actually watch the material that's being produced? It's almost like, you know, I've just seen people already walking around, two people with camcorders talking to each other through a camcorder. You know, and it's almost like earlier today you'd see a big debate, and like, we'd have a whole audience full of camcorders. People would come in, load the cassettes and the camcorders, all go up to the bar, the person will do the presentation, then come back, take the cassettes out of the camcorders and put the new cassettes in and go back. You know, and actually no one actually engages with each other, you know, just talking face to face unless it's mediated through a camcorder. It doesn't actually become real, which you actually see on the TV screen. And then, of course, you start to manipulate it by editing. That's just a few observations I've had so far today.
Can I ask a question? I'm interested in the biological model of the media. I'm writing a book about that very thing. It's called Virus. And it's really looking at things like the Amy Fisher thing and the Rodney King thing and Pee Wee Herman as cultural viruses, filled with memes that get released into popular culture. And I don't know that they're necessarily all bad. I don't know that that excrement is necessarily a bad thing, but they could be, in a sense, cultural self-regulatory devices that are spontaneously released by this great media organism, and only really take hold, like Amy Fisher or Rodney King, if there's a predisposition, if there's a cultural immune deficiency to those particular viruses as compared to other ones. And don't you think that even if people don't understand when they watch People's Court or America's Most Wanted Video or the 7,000 episodes of Current Affair that had Amy Fisher showing one part of her body or another, don't you think there's a certain kind of a cultural healing that goes on, or a cultural self-regulation that's spontaneously occurring that's forcing us to deal with issues that maybe we aren't fully capable of dealing with yet?
No. Well, I don't. Well, I agree with you right now. I like the notion of viruses, the notion of breakdown of immunity systems, all of that I would agree. But then why pull it back and talk about this as like kind of a cultural regulation system? It's not that at all. It's in fact a kind of burning blast of cultural decomposition. And that's why it's so interesting and fascinating, and why in fact it's tremendously innervating. It's biological in the sense that it's a different kind of biology. It's not a kind of human, the social biology that we used to know in the age of Darwinianism. It's really genuinely a recombinant biology. And that is that the technology now comes alive. and it has an operating war language. Its operating war language is that of cloning, splicing, retranscription of signals, and it needs its contents, and its contents is found in what I would call the post, in the, like a ruling logic, what I would call the postmodern primitive. And that is what's happening today in world culture, is in fact the meeting of, you know, the most advanced technological forms with the most primitive of human tendencies and human sensibilities itself. That's Amy Fisher. Amy Fisher's a story of real primitivism. It's a story about the, you know, the wife who's been done in by her husband to the point that she gets a gun blast in the face from a woman that she didn't even know exist, who her husband, you know, was disloyal to her. You know,
and sides with her husband,
right,
on Phil Donahue, yeah, and
yes,
Robert,
yes,
Rivera,
yes,
and everywhere else. She's,
yes,
still by her husband's side with a bullet lodged in her jaw,
right,
saying that she loves him and that she knows this woman was a tramp.
Yeah. And she had, both of them have their lawyer beside them, mm-hmm, as they talk. Well, because it's contractualism. That's the camcorder. When you're talking, I thought, well, yeah, that's a contractual self. The camcorder is just perfect to get your, you know, the representational story correct, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also immunization. I don't think that the audience would be, you know, you feel that the audience would be helped by seeing these activities, but I think they're immunized against it. And certainly, Amy Fisher's lover and the wife, going on Phil Donahue, and she holds his hand and says, people, you don't understand, we're just a happy, regular family. Why don't you just leave us alone? You know, so this is atmosphere out there that they're just another middle-class family living on Long Island, and they've been immunized for sure against seeing anything beyond there, because that's what's going to help them out. I don't know about the audience; they were sort of, you know, going back and forth.
Yes, so for me, that's what's at stake. Then, when I heard, that's why I got really disturbed last night when I heard, you know, these really acrid comments and really eloquent comments that the East Europeans were making about how, you know, that the shows that everyone likes is like the thing that kept being repeated was CNN and whatnot. Because you think, well, here's, you know, because I sit in Canada, you know, it's pretty benign, stupid culture next to the blast of the United States. And then you think of this really a sacrificial culture, like really a culture that's under the sign of liberal fascism, is sweeping the world today in the age of pure capitalism. With the eclipse of communism, there's nothing to stop liberal fascism. Marcuse went to his death. His last speech, he said that the tendency today is to the right. The life and death struggle for our generation will be whether corporate fascism can be prevented or not. And I think now, you know, 10 years after the death of Marcuse, the rightist tendencies under the guise of liberalism, you know, with the election of Clinton in the United States, are in fact intensifying. And it expresses itself aesthetically in terms of the hegemony of a mediascape that's deeply fascistic in character. And CNN certainly is that, because when people get CNN, they don't just get the American content on news. They get, in fact, something that's really viral. They get, in fact, you know, very sophisticated, recombinant culture that smashes local cultures apart. Because it's, if they thought the communists were against local culture, there's nothing more against local culture than liberal fascism, because it's delocalizing, decontextualizing, dehistoricizing, deterritorializing, and in fact, it doesn't even have any bodies in it. I mean, these are all recombinant scams that you see. So when the guy this morning talked about the puppets in Brazil, you know, well, I got news from him that they've always been on, you know, it's called Dan Rather in American television itself. So that's what I would call viral television. But I wouldn't give it a little self-regulation twist. That's the pragmatic turn in the American mind, I think.
Or the optimistic thinking. I mean, the other thing, the other great metaphor for the way the media has developed now is the chaos math sort of fractal metaphor, that you see all sorts of self-similarity and new forms of feedback and iteration occurring. Even in the Amy Fisher case, if you watched Geraldo, you would see in the screen of Geraldo was a screen of one of the TV movies that had shown the night before, two shows on the same night, actually. And in that frame of the TV movie was a tape, was a reenactment for the TV movie of a tape that one of Amy Fisher's boyfriends had made of her and he sort of seducing each other, and that frame was inside the frame of a press conference that was also being recreated. So we had six frames within frames. There was Geraldo, the TV movie, the current affair episode that was recreated for the TV movie, and the videotape as it was being shot that the current affair was supposed to be showing. so that there's this tremendous amount of media self-consciousness also, which I can't help but be optimistic about also, that somehow this can break the chain, that eventually there'll be enough frames on it, and that there's enough, like a fractal, there's enough self-similarity that we somehow move out of the planar horizontal plane of the fractal pattern into a more of a vertical realization of the thing that we're caught up in.
Yeah.
You'd say no.
No, I see that fantastic eloquence and naivety of the American mind is completely irresistible. Well, because at the end, it's technology is freedom, and you bow. But your description is just fantastic. I'll give you another description. We were passing through the Arizona desert last winter, and they were, just what they had there, it was the night before, a few hours before their first execution, which they were bringing back hanging. And they brought a reporter came on. She's a woman, and her claim to fame and her legitimacy for being on the air with this was that she was present at the execution of another serial killer, and that was Ted Bundy in Florida. So she was given like Bundy stories of, you know, lights going brown out and stuff like this. And then they wanted to do a quick reprise on the history of executions in Arizona. So I thought this would be pretty interesting. And so what came on then were Western snippets from Western films of you know, like, of guys being hanged. You just saw their cowboy boots, and there's a lot of, you know, all these scenes where the cowboys get hung and stuff like this. And the this went on for about 4 minutes, and the music track that they used for it was Terminator 2. So, it's a Judgment Day. So, there we have it. Well, that's recombinant culture. It's a culture, you know, like the language of, like, digital. The digital language has really come alive as, in fact, like a real political language. Like CNN uses, like, the notion of, you know, like the technique of, like, looping continuously, like the very notion of, you know, the resequencing, you know, the endless repetition and resequencing of stories on a 15-minute basis is just the looping technique itself, just as much as what you've described as displacement and aliasing techniques, you know, which you use like in digital sound technology. Those are used all the time for editing sequences and with imagery as well.
But I'd like to ask Kalindan from Romania, if it's true that you think about CNN, will CNN have a healing function in Romania, for example? You think, do you see something similar as Arthur said about
speaking for myself, I have a very critical opinion about CNN. I assimilated with what I experienced in Romania with the highly manipulated television. But that's speaking for myself. I mean, spreading it into the population will have a completely different effect, or maybe the same effect, because I was questioning myself before coming here to that conference, if it's not possible to look at the Ceausescu period and those 2 hours of emission about himself and his activity and his family like a kind of, at the same time, a kind of information agency. I mean, people were getting information about themselves. It wasn't purely propaganda. Propaganda is informing you of your own status, and at the same time it's giving you a mirror of yourself. So, and at the same time you could use those information, you know, those big shows made in honor of the dictator, like a kind of entertainment. Actually, I don't see a very big difference between, you know, popular shows which are going on Armenian TV and those things. I mean, they have the kind of the same structure. So I believe that CNN would be very, very quickly accepted and assimilated to a new truth, which actually is not at all new in terms of media making. It's a very old one. It's existing there as a kind of a local mentality. So, well, in my opinion, it's bad. And,
but people propose, let's say, a global signal to fight the nationalism. I mean, this is, I heard this many times.
What did you say, sir?
So that you, if people look enough, CNN and BBC,
nationalism is another form of authority. CNN is giving another level of authority, which is, you know, it's so general that you don't perceive it. You don't perceive it as really aggressive. I mean, you know, there is a small group saying one thing, around it lots of groups who are disagreeing, maybe. But CNN is like a cover, you know. I mean, you cannot disagree with the sky. I mean, maybe it's raining or something. But I don't like the CNN sky, really.
Could you react on it?
Yeah, no, I agree. It is like the sky for sure. Whereas in Canada, I'd say it's like the snow. And all you can do is, like one Canadian filmmaker, Lefebvre, said, all you can do is keep shoveling all the time. That was his description of technology, is that the debris of technology keeps falling on us. In some ways. Yeah. The only thing I would add to that is, like, maybe what CNN in Romania does is that it finally does what the communists couldn't do and gives Romania a state of pure communism in some ways. That is, it spreads over the culture like the sky. Communism in this more primitive sense as common penetration of the image by everyone. And it creates a kind of a relationship between media and power, which is based upon, like, really hegemonic tendencies, in the sense that the ruling class becomes these specialists without spirit, these kind of, the corporate apparatchik of the mediascape itself. Its content is the information economy, which is excremental in character. Its memory is what Gerrit has described as the universal media archive, you know, this kind of floating park zone that everyone finds themselves in one zone or another. And its ruling logic is biology. You know, it's like a merger, it's a relationship today, deep relationship between technology and biology, when television becomes alive and becomes, in fact, deeply viral in character. And it's imprinted on everyone by a particular kind of conflation in this age of television, and that is that television, the sophisticated technology of television, works best when it inscribes itself into the most primitivist of human tendencies, the most primitivist of tendencies in human psychology itself. And the culture that's done that the best is the United States. And I think what American culture is today is a culture of the postmodern primitive. It's the meeting of digital recombinant culture, you know, the full technological apparatus of television with an element of, with in fact finding its energizing form by scouring the culture for pathological primitivist fascistic tendencies, basically. At least their consequence is really fascistic, in the sense that they're used in the United States, for example, of, you know, like scapegoating. You can scapegoat anyone in the United States, and not in a kind of functional way, but just for what to perform the function that scapegoating always does, and that is to create a kind of temporary coherence of the population around the victimization of outgroups. And anyone can be a member of the excluded outgroup. You can be a gay in the United States, and you can be excluded on the issue of AIDS. You can be an African American and become a sacrificial victim. The definition of the scapegoat is completely irrelevant, because scapegoating works not to really punish the victim, although it'll certainly do that. Scapegoating in television always works to perform the very traditional function of providing a basis of moral cohesion of the community. And I think in the world culture of television, the logic of scapegoating is its most primitivist logic that's used on a worldwide scale.
Like, this gentleman there said something about healing. If you are thinking about healing in terms of shamanic practices or sacrificial practices, maybe it's a kind of healing what you're talking about.
Yeah. Not for me. Yeah. Well, not for me, because I don't think that sacrificial culture works on the basis of traditional sacrifice. You know, where traditional sacrifice had a purpose to it. It was to bond the community together. It was, in fact, to represent healing. I should have used another term, and that is that it's the age of cynical sacrifice. There's, you know, the Dutch thinker, Sloterdijk, Peter Sloterdijk?
German.
Okay. The German thinker, Peter Sloterdijk, you know, in his book on cynical reason, says that what happens in contemporary media culture is that every term gets turned. And so I would say, so like cynicism is turned into its opposite, where cynicism once was, you know, like a notion of like a rebellious logic from below, like the logic of tactical television against strategic television. Now cynicism means truth-telling by elites who deny that they can do otherwise as they sort of punish the, you know, as they discipline the population. It's, you know, cynical cynicism. It's a movement from cynicism to cynicism. Well, I'd say with sacrifice is exactly the same thing. It's a movement from traditional sacrifice to cynical sacrifice. And cynical sacrifice is about the directing of the logic of scapegoating against victims just for the fun of it. And anyone can be a victim. It has no purpose. So, TV.
Okay.
do you think that there's anyone creating media sensations or media viruses that that can potentially even have a good effect or a civilizing effect on the fascistic primitive that we're all in danger of becoming? For example, any kind of AIDS.